Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, March 14th, 2018.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. 1 month ago, 17 people were killed at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. What immediately followed was a familiar and grim American script, a debate about assault weapons and constitutional rights and hardening schools and thoughts and prayers for victims.
It only happens here not because of coincidence, not because of bad luck, but as a consequence of our inaction.
I've already announced, and I hope they will pass it. I really think they will, and they should. A concept called a gun violence restraining order.
The familiar backdrop to a familiar form of tragedy was on repeat. And then something different happened.
All these people should be at home grieving. But instead, we are up here standing together because if all our government and president can do is send thoughts and prayers, then it's time for victims to be the change that we need to see.
Students from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School forced themselves into the debate. They appeared on cable news, they took over town halls, and they started to change the script of American mass shootings.
No more silence and gun violence! Enough is enough! Enough is enough!
Well, today, across the country, tens of thousands of students at hundreds of schools are walking out, demonstrating, determined, they say, to upend the pattern of violence and hand-wringing and inaction.
My class, a senior class, was born in 1999 and 2000. Columbine happened in 1999. So we've lived this through our entire upbringing, but we've never really had a voice in the actual issue. My name is Parker Butler, and I'm a senior at Liberty High School in Frisco, Texas.
This is the first time that America can see firsthand what those kids had to go through, and that's why this time is going to be different.
My name is Frankie Gaynor. I'm a senior at Coral Glades High School in Coral Springs, Florida.
I'm Allison Guarini, and I'm a senior at Elyria High School in Ohio. Honestly, I think that my classmates and I just decided that enough is enough.
Enough is enough has become a slogan of this burgeoning student protest movement. I talked with Allison and Frankie and Parker.
We are really focused on the gun issue. We have met with our administration. We've talked about school safety, and they have taken our requests seriously. But what we want to do is to try to make this more of something that is about getting involved in democracy, getting involved in politics, to try to create that change legislatively and try to affect this change so that we don't have these kinds of shootings anymore, or at least so that there are less of these kinds of shootings.
Allison, what about you at your school? Have you seen sort of a singular focus on guns, or are people more focused on sort of general school safety? As you organize and talk to your classmates and decide what your message is, what are people saying?
Our main message for this event is to show how we stand in support with Parkland. We're paying tribute to the victims and to everyone from all school shootings that have happened. So all throughout history, Columbine, Sandy Hook, Virginia Tech, everything. This event is just to show our support and about making schools safer all over the country.
Now, Allison, you go to a school that has been in a lockdown situation before, as I understand it, right? You've been through a bomb threat, and that sort of suggests to me that maybe you have a personal sense of what it means to fear for your life, or at least to question what's going on when a school goes into a security lockdown.
Yes, last year, towards the end of the year, my school went into lockdown. We had a bomb threat, but at the time, we didn't know what was happening. The principals came on and said, hey, don't switch classes yet. And we were all kind of confused on what was happening. We didn't have any details, and we were locked in our rooms for the next 2 hours or so. Nobody had any details. Everyone was trying to text each other. My room didn't have any service, so it was a lot of fear of having no idea what was going on, and you were hearing a bunch of different stories from a bunch of different people, and it's nothing compared to what shooting victims and Stoneman has been through and anything, but it's enough to have that fear and being so scared of what's going on and not knowing what's happening. And when we finally got out, nothing happened, thankfully. But when we finally got out and you see the news trucks all over and the parents crying and reaching and trying to find their children, being involved in that type of panic really hits close to home.
Well, Frankie, what about you? What's the plan for the walkouts at Coral Glades? Again, you're so close, 8 minutes away from Stoneman Douglas High School. You're right there where this tragedy happened. So it's going to get coverage when you guys walk out. What's the plan?
Our plan is to walk out at 10 a.m. and to sit in the hallways holding hands for 17 minutes of silence, just to continue to show solidarity. It's still a walkout, but it's still not the same chaotic scene as 2,000 people walking to the front of the school and standing there. So it's still our way of showing that we stand with them by walking out and sitting in.
Now, Parker, you go to school, let's face it, in a red state, a pretty pro-gun state, a pretty conservative state there in Texas. Not everybody agrees on all these issues, that's for sure. But a big part of this movement and a big part of the reaction to Parkland, of course, is about guns. And I wonder if you've heard from other students who don't agree with your stance here or might be planning some kind of actions of their own.
Texas, yeah, as you said, it's sort of ground zero for sort of this pro-NRA, what they would call pro-gun state. It's really common to see sort of pro-gun people actively, you know, engaged in this issue. And yes, I have encountered lots of people who have been either uneasy or just flat out disagree with what we're saying. In fact, there were a couple of students who were saying that they wanted to form a pro-NRA walkout during the same time as our walkout.
Is there a real open kind of honest debate going on? Is it part of class or teachers involved? Are you guys exchanging ideas for real in a way that you think is constructive?
There has been a lot of constructive debate. Certainly it comes with talking about politics. There is obviously some partisanship where people don't actually want to have an honest discussion, and then they try to frame the other side as, you know, taking away the Second Amendment or whatever. But for the most part, I think I've talked with a lot of students. Several classes have sort of embedded what has happened in Parkland within their curriculum. People really do care about this issue because we all see it. We all know it could very well be us. So we're not blind to that fact. And we want to have an honest discussion to that. And I think I've had a lot of discussions with people in my own classes, people who maybe they don't agree entirely, maybe they're more moderate on the issue. But what I always tell them is that, like, okay, you can have that opinion, and I perfectly hear that. But the problem is that we aren't doing anything at all. So we can disagree on what specific regulations there should be, et cetera. But Congress doesn't even do anything after these shootings. They are so blind to this fact. They are so controlled by the National Rifle Association that they can't even do any common sense measure. So the debate is not whether which measure should we implement. The debate is more about what should we do? Can we do even one thing to try to prevent these shootings from occurring?
Well, Parker, talk about that a little bit more, how you think this could become a student-led movement. Look, where so many other people, at least who are on your side of the gun debate, have failed. This debate, as you know, has raged for decades in Washington and has basically gotten nowhere in Congress or really anywhere else. What can students accomplish here that nobody else has?
This year, 2018, will be the first year I'll be able to vote. It'll be the first year a lot of people will be able to vote this November. I think what you're going to see is that it's going to change because it's inevitable, because we are getting older, because we are going to have more of a voice in our institutions and in civic life, because simply that's how it works when a generation comes of age.
So I want to talk about success and sustainability in this movement, because guys, let's face it, we live in a pretty episodic kind of society, especially with social media. Something's hot for a minute or for a day, and then it kind of goes away. Now, you guys have been around for longer than a day, that's true. How are you going to prevent your protest just kind of becoming part of the background noise and then lawmakers and powerful people sort of just move on because they don't feel the heat? Have you talked about sort of end goals and how to be successful here? Allison, you go first.
We had so many students that wanted to be involved in the walkout and in planning this activity that we've created a club, Students Stand Up, which will deal with social issues throughout the year. So it'll forever be an ongoing thing. We're focusing on supporting Parkland right now, but in the long run will help seniors become voters, helping contact officials, legislators, whatever any student activist feels they need or want to do, they have the support.
So Frankie, I can't imagine that you're very interested in being one and done here with this walkout. I have a strong sense that you care about reaching results. So what's the plan?
as of right now, the plan is just to keep it in the news cycle and just to not let it be a passing memory. Because I agree with what you said, that a lot of society with social media, it makes a lot of the things that happen kind of pass over almost immediately after the news cycle is over. So our plan is to, well, we already have March for Our Lives on March 24th. That's going to carry our movement. And I'm assuming it's going to be an annual thing. And I don't see people letting anyone forget the name Stoneman Douglas. I don't imagine anyone, because I really truly believe that never again means never again, and that this is going to be the last mass school shooting, because it absolutely has to be, because I don't know how many more. And we've already seen some legislative progress, especially in Florida, where governor signed into effect that there will have to be a 3-day waiting period for certain weapons and raise the minimum age to purchase an assault rifle from 18 to 21. So we already have been making legislative strides, and that's just further proves to me that we're actually going to make a difference, and that our end goal, which is to just have common sense gun laws, is going to come to fruition.
Well, how much are your fellow students talking about voting, talking about getting the chance to vote, even maybe having voter registration as a big part of senior year or even in school? Parker, is it a big discussion there in Frisco?
I think it's becoming certainly a larger thing. As Frankie said, I think we want to apply that model that Florida has taken with regards to producing change, even in a state vastly controlled by Republicans, and applying that to Texas. We have one of the most pro-NRA senators, Ted Cruz, as well as John Cornyn, our state legislators dominated by Republicans, governor, et cetera. We want to apply that change. We can already see Texas is trending to become more of a blue state, or at least a purple state. And so I think we're going to walk out of school. We're going to register people to vote. We're going to add people to an email list and a phone number list. And we're going to get people involved in this issue. Because I think what this really is about is that there's a lot of students who they care about this issue, but they don't know where to go from here. And so what we want to do is give students the resources and the means by which they can get involved on the political level in ways that most students, let's face it, they don't know what it takes to, you know, volunteer for a campaign or to register other people to vote. They don't know these things. And so what we want to do is try to use that energy, you know, people caring about this issue, and to try to make that into a more robust thing. And I think we are starting to see that in Frisco. We're starting to see that in Texas. We saw the primaries here in Texas just a couple of weeks ago had record turnout, you know. So it is starting to happen, but what we want to do is to try to, you know, make that happen at an even faster rate.
Allison, what about the swing state of Ohio? Voting's a big deal in Ohio. It should be everywhere, but everyone really cares about Ohio and how people vote. Are kids talking about voting there?
Yeah, we have a lot of students interested in voting. This upcoming year, we've had hundreds, probably. My school is 2,000 people. We've had hundreds come up to us and ask us how we can get involved and how we can register. And if they're not 18 yet, when can they vote? And we have a lot of that going on, which is a very good sign.
Allison Guarini at Elyria High School in Ohio. Allison, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Parker Butler, senior at Liberty High School in Frisco, Texas. Parker, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Frankie Gaynor at Coral Glades High School, just up the road from Stoneman Douglas High in Florida. Frankie, thanks to you as well.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity.
President Trump shook up the national security world with a single tweet on Tuesday. The first part announced that CIA Director Mike Pompeo would replace Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State. Tillerson had been fired in a separate tweet. And then the president named Gina Haspel as his choice to be the first woman to lead the CIA as director. Haspel is currently the agency's deputy director, and she has a long career in the CIA's clandestine service. That career included overseeing torture at a CIA black site in Thailand after 9/11, and also ordering the destruction of video evidence of that torture. Tim Weiner is author of Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA, and he joins me now. Tim, welcome.
My pleasure.
What did Gina Haspel's career look like at the CIA before 9/11?
She's 61. She spent more than half her life working at CIA, always in the clandestine service. She served all over the world in stations in Europe in what the CIA calls denied areas, such as Russia. And throughout what the CIA calls the Third World, she rose to senior positions in the counterterrorism operation and the clandestine service, that's the spies worldwide. And in CIA terms, she would have had a stellar and untarnished career were it not for the months that she spent running the CIA's secret prison in Thailand.
Well, let's talk about that time, because that's a period in Gina Haspel's career that's likely to come out when she goes before the Senate to be confirmed. If she's confirmed, she'll be the first woman to lead the CIA. But let's talk about her role right after 9/11. What was her involvement in the CIA's torture program after 9/11?
In 2002, the CIA had set up a secret prison in Thailand on the edge of an airbase in the north of the country. And into that secret prison landed Abu Zubaydah, whom the CIA believed and whom the CIA told President Bush was the number three man in al-Qaeda. Gina Haspel presided over his torture. He was waterboarded 83 times, buried in a coffin-like box, and really taken to the point of the edge of death. Haspel argued for tightening the screws on him, and the screws were tightened.
Was any useful information ever extracted from Abu Zubaydah?
Before he was tortured, he told the FBI interrogators talking to him, led by Ali Sufan, useful information. After the torture was applied, he said anything to stop the torture. And so the CIA derived false information by inflicting pain upon him.
And what about Abd al-Rahim al-Nashri, who's in Guantanamo Bay right now?
Same basic story. Maybe the screws were not quite as tight on him. But the key here is, A, that Haspel oversaw the torture of these guys. And B, 3 years later, she drafted the order destroying 92 videotapes of this torture.
And that order to destroy the evidence of the torture got the attention of Senate investigators and several senators, too. And that information, it seems, Tim Weiner, is likely to come back in a big way when she goes in front of the Senate to be confirmed.
Well, that's right. It was the destruction of the tapes that prompted Senate investigators to do the work that led to a 7,000-page report on CIA's use of torture, which has never been declassified. And we will now revisit this sorry tale during her confirmation hearings. I do not envy her that experience.
Well, President Trump has said that he thinks torture works. But more broadly, what signal to other governments do you think this nomination sends? Gina Haspel has a long career at the CIA. She certainly knows the agency. But being a central part of extraordinary rendition and torture, even though those things are now illegal under U.S. law, it seems to me will send a message to other countries now that she's been nominated for this top post. What will that message be?
The fact is, in the 15 years since this torture took place, Gina Haspel has rocketed up through the ranks of CIA. That sends a message. It tells the world that the president wants a CIA director who conducted torture, and that he thinks it's a great idea. That is a stain on the honor of the United States.
Are CIA personnel divided on their views of Gina Haspel? And I ask it because CIA personnel seem to be certainly divided on the legacy of this era that you're describing. Many of them, of course, believe and know that they were executing the orders of the commander-in-chief or doing what was necessary. Many CIA personnel think that it was a black stain, as you say, on the agency itself.
Well, I think the CIA rank and file are probably happy to have a professional officer, one of their own, in power. It rarely works out great when politicians are appointed to direct the CIA. And I think they will close ranks behind her. I also think, you know, here we are, the CIA is now more than 70 years old. This is the first woman ever to rise to the top of the chain of command. I think it will be difficult for some senators to beat her up during her confirmation hearings on that score. But I think if John McCain is healthy enough, McCain having served more than 7 years as a prisoner of war, a man who is unalterably opposed to torture. If Senator McCain ever knocks heads with Gina Haspel, that will be one for the ages.
Well, Tim, before we go, clearly we're about to revisit the era of torture in the CIA and in the war on terror. That's all going to be made public again, at least what's not classified. What do you think the country is going to gain from reprising all this history when Gina Haspel inevitably comes before the Senate?
Well, this will be the first open discussion of this terrible chapter in our history. And good for us for finally getting around to this 15 years after the fact. It's a terrible, terrible, terrible episode. And yet the CIA can say, as a Nuremberg defense, we were just following orders. Well, that didn't work too well for the Germans after World War II, and I think it won't work that well for the CIA today.
Gina Haspel to be nominated, according to President Trump, to lead the CIA. Senate hearings ahead of us. Tim Weiner is author of Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA. Tim, thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
The political world watched Rex Tillerson yesterday. The drama as the Secretary of State was shoved out the door by a tweet from his boss, President Trump. That was on the main stage of Trump world. Meanwhile, on the side stage, where you could have missed it, another more intimate presidential advisor was actually shoved out the door. John McAtee was an assistant to the president, relatively unknown in Washington, and by all counts, a loyal confidant of President Trump. Then, yesterday, John McAtee was physically removed from the White House, apparently under investigation for what was described as serious financial crimes. Ben Strauss is the contributing writer for Politico magazine, and he's here with the story.
So John McAtee is kind of a fascinating guy in the White House. He is Trump's body man. So this is the physically closest person to Donald Trump all day, every day. Walks with him to the residence in the morning, travels with him constantly. He's the guy standing next to him, you know, really 24/7. And his story is sort of a quintessential Trump world story. Johnny McAtee rose to fame in 2011 as a college quarterback at the University of Connecticut when he posted a trick shot video on YouTube that has over 7 million hits today.
What's up? This is Johnny McAtee representing UConn football. Trick shot video.
He's throwing footballs and knocking bottles off people's heads, that kind of thing. But he's essentially not a political actor until he gets involved in the Trump campaign as a volunteer in 2015. And he starts out essentially making copies and proves himself to the staff, you know, eventually rising to the level where he's making plans on the road, making sure Trump has the food he eats, and has this trait that Trump prizes above all, which is unequivocal loyalty. When I wrote about Johnny last year, his dad told me that he absolutely loves the president, that he's a lockbox, won't even say a bad word about him to his father.
And so on Tuesday, when the political world was watching the abrupt ouster of Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, over at the White House, Johnny McAtee, it comes out, is basically shoved off the property, escorted out of the White House so quickly he couldn't even grab his jacket. What happened?
So there's a security clearance issue here. And as others have reported, and some of our reporting has backed up, is it's related to online gambling and his taxes. And so what exactly the details are of that, we're not sure. But, you know, when you have an issue like that, there aren't questions asked. There aren't, you know, explanations sought. You are immediately removed from the premises. So how serious it is, what exactly it is, we don't know. What we do know is that the campaign knows what he's getting investigated for, and they are happily willing to give him a campaign job. And essentially, he was transferred from his White House duties to an advisor on the Trump campaign.
People talk about the president's inner circle and the small group of people around him who help temper his anger and his impulsive nature. Those people have been Hope Hicks, communications director, who's now gone from the White House, Keith Schiller, longtime security guard, who's now gone from the White House, and now Johnny McAtee, who was listed as one of those inner circle confidants as well.
Yeah, you have this incredible winnowing of people that Trump, you know, is really comfortable talking to, really comfortable being around. The follow-up question is sort of, what does this mean? And I spent a while yesterday talking to a former you know, business associate of Trump's, you know, asking him, you know, now that all these people are gone, what does it mean? And he sort of laughed at me, honestly, and he said, you know, this is really no different than it's been for the last 40 years. And so the idea that he's become lonely in the White House, or that, you know, he's lost these advisors, perhaps almost gives the advisors too much credit, or suggests that there's some sort of calming influence that Hope Hicks has or somebody else has. And, you know, this associate was saying there is no calming influence. This is the same guy he's been his whole life. And whether Hope Hicks is around, whether Keith Schiller is around, whether Johnny McEntee is around, you know, he's still going to be the same guy.
Ben Strauss, contributing writer for Politico magazine. Ben, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Have you seen the really bad schools? Maybe try to figure out what they're doing.
I have not intentionally visited schools that are underperforming.
That was Education Secretary Betsy DeVos in an interview with Leslie Stahl on the CBS show 60 Minutes on Sunday. The interview got a lot of attention. DeVos was not able to speak in detail about the state of public schools in general or how schools are performing in her home state of Michigan. But Betsy DeVos had no experience in public education policy before President Trump appointed her Secretary of Education. She did have a long career of advocacy and activism, mostly for religious schools and privatization. Here she is back in 2015.
We must open up the education industry, and let's not kid ourselves that it isn't an industry. We're the beneficiaries of startups, ventures, and innovation in every other area of life. But we don't have that in education because it's a closed system, a closed industry, a closed market. It's a monopoly, a dead end.
The federal role in public education is relatively small. Most of the funding comes from states and local governments, but 90% of American students go to public schools. So a year into her tenure, how is Betsy DeVos's philosophy shaping public education policy? Liz Willen is editor-in-chief of the Hechinger Report. They're a nonprofit education news outlet. She told me in education, it's hard to say exactly what's changed under Betsy DeVos.
There really haven't been a lot of important changes. What there has been is a lack of clear policy. I mean, she's got a highly visible position as the head of the Department of Education, a really important platform. And I think that she has not been able to instill any confidence in a vision. She is rather tone deaf in many occasions I've seen her speak to different crowds, and she recounts the same themes repeatedly. Choice is good. Government is bad. Kids are trapped in failing schools. School choice is everything. And I think she has a problem listening to what the public in public education is saying, because she isn't really necessarily a champion of public education.
Well, have there been any new policies to back up that philosophy that you've heard repeated? We've certainly heard of plenty of deregulation, or at least Obama-era regulations being stopped or slowed down.
There's no question. In terms of loan forgiveness, she wants to forgive, only partially forgive, the loans of students who attended for-profit schools, and many of them have since shut down. That threat alone is very worrying for tens of thousands of older and non-traditional students who've been deceived by schools that are now defunct, and many of these schools also collapsed after being accused of widespread fraud. DeVos has openly questioned and actively rolled back the Obama administration's loan forgiveness policies. And these are policies that help thousands of students cancel some $550 million in student debt.
There's also been a lot of controversy over guidelines over how college campuses should manage sexual assault complaints. What's happened with that policy?
Well, there's no question with that. And in her now quite famous interview with Leslie Stahl, she repeatedly said one student is too much, one accusation is too much, but did not articulate, once again, a clear policy for what it is that she wants to do here.
Well, we've talked about some of the older students in America at college campuses, for-profit colleges, and others. Let's talk about younger kids. Betsy DeVos has been a vocal proponent of private and religious charter schools. Has she advanced any of those policies now that she has a government job?
She's trying to, but she's not able to do that in many cases. Look, she's got a big fight ahead. And I think the one thing that I noticed in her confirmation hearings, which were, as you can recall, were all night, tie-breaking vote by Vice President Mike Pence was the only way that she was confirmed. You saw an outcry, an outpouring of passion and support for public education. And that is continuing. She runs into that wherever she goes. When she was asked about her policies about Michigan, she was unable to say that the schools were actually doing better and acknowledged that she had not visited any of the schools that were underperforming. She has thus far been unable to create the kind of widespread choice policies that she so very much wants to have, in part because the public isn't having it and she's under siege for discussing these ideas and pushing them against the will of many in the public sector.
Well, Liz, you live and write in a world of details of education policy, and I know you have a lot of readers who are into the details of education policy. They're looking at a Secretary of Education now. What do you think is going on here? Is this as simple as someone being installed into this job who cares about education, has advocated for certain kinds of education, but really doesn't have any experience at all making or executing policy? Is that what's going on here?
That's absolutely the case. It started right with her confirmation hearing, and she wasn't able to answer questions. At one point, I don't know if you recall, she made headlines for telling Democrat Senator Chris Murphy that some schools may require guns to fight off quote-unquote potential grizzly bears. And, you know, now she's championing teachers using guns or potentially using having guns in classrooms, which is a cornerstone of what President Trump wants to do. She's run into a great deal of opposition for that as well.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment, because President Trump this week has put Betsy DeVos in charge of a new federal commission on school safety. Part of what the White House, or the president, I should say, wants from this is a policy that would allow teachers to have concealed carry permits in the classroom. What is Betsy DeVos's role going to be here, and what impact is she likely to have on this huge national debate now on school safety after Parkland?
She's going to be a lightning rod for criticism for this, because this is a very unpopular policy, except for with the NRA. This White House proposal is, according to many teachers and principals who are weighing in heavily, my inbox is flooded with remarks, and they are complaining that it ignores the purpose of public education. They feel that it's dangerous and that it is just straight out of the NRA playbook.
It sounds like people involved in public education have a lot of frustration with Betsy DeVos. I can hear it in your voice as well. What can she do? What changes can she implement at the Department of Education to try to get some confidence of educators around the country?
That's an excellent question, but her ideology and her ideas around this concern getting the government out of the business of a lot of these education decisions. She wants states and communities to address the issues in their own way. That is something she talks about over and over again. She is also talking a lot about innovation. Last week, I heard her speak in front of a crowd in Austin, Texas at South by Southwest EDU, and she had an unprecedented opportunity there. And at another conference, I heard her speak last spring about innovation and technology in schools. But she instead complains over and over again about students being trapped in failing schools, even when she has an empathetic audience who is also wanting change and pushing innovation. So one thing she might be able to do is to get some of those folks on her side and on board in talking about the way she wants to change schools. She refers to the factory model of education and has yet to visit a school where she can champion real change, real innovation, and say, hey, this is something we need to do more of in this country to close achievement gaps or to make things different or to improve education in radical ways.
Liz Whelan, editor-in-chief of the Hechinger Report, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For 24 years, on Sunday from midnight to 6 a.m., a radio program broadcast across the mountains and into the jungles of Colombia.
Sí, muy buenos días. Agradeciendo a Caracol Noticias y señor Edwin Hoyos.
Voces del Secuestro, or Voices of the Kidnapped. In a mix of music and newscasts, that show aired messages sent by family members and friends who were missing loved ones. People caught up in the country's decades-long war with FARC and other groups. Thousands of the missing have been reunited with their families over the years. Thousands of others have not.
Some parts of the government say 60,000. Some NGOs say 100,000. Part of the issue is that a lot of people, until recently, were living in areas that were still conflict areas. So people might not have reported it because they were threatened or because they were scared. So there's a good number of cases now that are coming out after the peace deal that the authorities didn't even know about.
That's Julia Sims Cobb, now a Bogota-based journalist for Reuters, who, alongside photographer Juan Cristobal Cobo, documented the stories of families who used Voces del Secuestro to connect with missing families. But even for Colombians who had not lost a family member, the show was an outlet for a reckoning with their country's dark past.
Colombia's disappeared. It's a phenomenon that's been going on for more than 50 years. The country has had a civil conflict that started in 1964, parts of which are coming to an end now because of peace deals and demobilizations, but other parts of which continue. There's a lot of actors involved in the conflict here. There were rebel groups. There used to be multiple ones. Now there's just one active rebel group. There were also a lot of paramilitary gangs, as well as drug trafficking groups and the governments, the military that was fighting this ongoing civil conflict. And so the disappeared can be almost anyone. Some of them are social leaders or people who are involved in unions who were killed by one armed group or another because that armed group was trying to take control of certain territory and they didn't want to deal with community members who were fighting back. Some are journalists or other human rights lawyers, activists of some kind, members of certain political parties, and others that disappeared are just regular people who might have been in the wrong place at the wrong time or who were killed in commission of some other crime like robbery and their bodies were disappeared, or they're someone who is taken hostage.
So, Julia, this radio program, Voces del Secuestro, has gotten some notoriety in recent years, but it's been on the air for decades in Colombia. How did it get started?
Well, Voces del Secuestro was started 24 years ago by a journalist named Erbin Hoyos, and he was kidnapped by the FARC. And during his kidnapping, he was chained up next to another hostage. And that other hostage said to him, you know, you're a journalist. I don't ever hear anything about hostages like me. We listen to the radio here all the time, and we've always got it on, and they let us listen, but nobody ever talks about this problem. And so when Erbin was freed, he went back to his radio station and proposed that they start a show that would literally be a voice for the kidnapped, where families could call in to the radio show and leave a message for a loved one who is missing. People who are kidnapped could hear those messages from their families.
After decades on the air, I mean, there were thousands of families who reached out or tried to reach out to loved ones who were disappeared or kidnapped. Talk about the Mora family, because they're one of them.
So the Mora family, Miriam and Rafael, they're high school sweethearts, and one of their sons, Juan Camilo, went missing. He was 27. He went missing in 2006, and they're one of the families that really held out until the show ended. So the Moras called every weekend for Juan Camilo.
Today I heard the song Color of Hope, a melody that transported me to December 31st, 2005. When you danced and sang happily with your beautiful little daughter, happy to have all the family together, looking after everyone with the love that characterized you.
The daily routine is always the same. Going to work, my classes. Life has continuity in the midst of this whole situation. But son, what takes us out of the routine sometimes is thinking of you, is recognizing that I love you so much.
And what about Leonor Carreño? She's another longtime caller.
Leonor calls for her brother Jorge, who was a member of the security services who disappeared.
Little brother, I care for you. I love you. Take care of yourself. Remember, there is a family waiting for you with open arms. The doors of my house are open, awaiting your arrival.
He's her younger brother, and she's really committed to the idea that because of his security service training and because of who he was as a person, that he will have survived whatever was put in his way. So she likes to call and just give him a message of perseverance and that, you know, God is looking out for him and the family is waiting for him.
I send the message and I feel relief, like now I can sleep.
Are there cases where we know somebody was kidnapped, abducted, being held, and they were listening?
Oh, certainly. I mean, according to the show's figures that they maintain, the database that they had, there are 24,000 families who called in over the show's lifetime. And of those 24,000, 20,000 of those people were eventually freed in some way, either rescued or ransomed or what have you. So the majority of people whose families called into the show came back alive.
And what have, if I can ask, what have kidnappers, abductors say about the show?
I mean, certainly what the show got from people who were held and then were freed was that hostage takers really liked the show in a weird way, because it was a way of keeping hostages calm. You let them listen. It's kind of a treat. It allows them to feel connected to their family, and was a way that kidnappers could sort of keep people from reckless escape attempts, from fighting back. At the height of the kidnapping problem in Colombia, the armed groups wanted these people to stay alive because they wanted to ransom them.
So, Julia, a show on the air for 24 years, it's become a staple in Colombia for very grim reasons, has now gone off the air. Is that the crossover point? Is that the point that tells Colombians that times have finally changed in their country, that a program like this is no longer needed?
I think it's debatable whether or not it's no longer needed. I mean, certainly for the families who continued calling in until the end, it kind of reinforces a sense of abandonment that they've had for a long time, that, you know, the state doesn't really care and isn't really motivated to help them find their loved ones or help them get answers about what happened. And certainly the former members of the armed groups don't care to help them either. Under the peace deal with the FARC, when they demobilize, are supposed to go through this process of talking about the crimes that they committed as rebels, or, you know, when they were in the jungles or up in the mountains, and giving as much information as they can about those crimes. So displacements, disappearances, murders, sexual violence. That process is going really slowly and is in some ways really disorganized. So I think that the show ending sort of reinforces that feeling that a lot of these families have, that this is an issue that's going to be buried and they're not going to necessarily get the answers they want. For Colombia as a broader country, I think it certainly does signal that times are changing, but that doesn't necessarily mean that all the wounds from, you know, 5 decades of conflict are healing.
Voces del Secuestro, off the air in Colombia after 24 years. The voices of the families of the disappeared in that country. Julia Sims Cobb for Reuters, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Under extreme conditions, general relativity and quantum theory allow time to behave like another dimension of space. This removes the distinction between time and space, and means the laws of evolution can also determine the initial state. The universe can spontaneously create itself out of nothing.
Renowned physicist and popular science hero Stephen Hawking has died. He was 76. Back in 1963, Stephen Hawking was diagnosed with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease. Doctors gave him less than 3 years to live, but he spent 5.5 more decades stunning fellow scientists and dazzling the general public with his research into black holes and the very nature of the universe. Emily Rice is a professor of astrophysics at the CUNY College of Staten Island, and she joins me now to talk about Stephen Hawking's legacy. Emily, welcome back.
Hi, Todd.
Well, there are these two sides to Stephen Hawking's public life, you know, how he helped millions of regular people understand the origins of the universe. And then, of course, his scientific work, way over the heads of most of us. Talk about that work and what Stephen Hawking accomplished.
His scientific accomplishments are just unprecedented, I would almost say. You know, unfortunately, he wasn't awarded a Nobel Prize, but really he worked on one of the biggest problems that we have. It's still not finished, but his contribution to it is certainly amazing. This kind of idea of trying to unify quantum mechanics, which is our understanding of the smallest particles in the universe, with the universe as a whole, and gravity and general relativity, the expansion, even the formation of the universe to begin with. And this is something that it's really, you know, it's called the grand unified theory, and it's going to put all of our big ideas together into the biggest possible idea and kind of our biggest understanding of the universe possible. And he really made huge contributions to that, starting with things that seemed almost impossible.
The search for that grand unified theory took Stephen Hawking down black holes out there in the far reaches of the universe, even at the center of our own galaxy. And he sort of took us with him on that journey. What did his work on black holes do to inform this scientific work that you're talking about?
So his work on black holes really applied our understanding of black holes, or I don't even want to say our, I want to say his understanding of black holes at the time, to the universe as a whole. So the idea was that there's this singularity at the center of the black hole, this kind of infinite region of curvature of the universe, and the curvature of the universe is what we usually describe with general relativity. And the idea that an expanding universe should have started with a Big Bang existed around Hawking's time when he started his research, but that the universe could have also started as a singularity, and that there could be this parallel between a black hole and the universe as a whole, was really a new idea that he worked on. And as he worked on it, they realized it might not just be a coincidence, but it might help us understand the universe as a whole, that these two things really might be the same.
You know, Emily, we have this sense that scientists were kind of blown away by Stephen Hawking's work, and then the rest of us groundlings were just kind of amazed by the books he wrote and his television appearances. But what about for you as a young student or a scientist, or what have your physics or cosmology colleagues said to you about the career of Stephen Hawking?
I don't think you could find a physicist who hasn't been influenced by Stephen Hawking. Mine was only very indirect. Of course, I read A Brief History of Time. I think I didn't read it until college, honestly, but it's great even when you're trying to study science, because a lot of the times, you struggle in classes, you get bogged down by homework and equations and problem sets. And then to read the words so beautifully describing these things, it kind of could reinvigorate your enthusiasm about it and say, okay, I really understand this. You know, I can understand through words from this genius scientist, I can do this problem set. I can understand this equation. I can finish this problem. I never got the chance to see him speak or meet him personally, but I've just heard so many wonderful stories from colleagues that emphasized really his sense of humor. You know, even though his body was debilitated by ALS, he could still make a statement without words. And often that involved running over people's feet with his wheelchair.
Stephen Hawking, dead at 76. Emily Rice is professor of astrophysics at the CUNY College of Staten Island. Emily, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And this note, it was a life bookended by the giants of physics. Stephen Hawking was born on the 300th anniversary of the death of Galileo, and he died on the birthday of Albert Einstein. And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.